appeal. You know, you've probably, I'm sure, read the petition, both petitions, and you know, or both briefs, rather, and you know that the issue here is notice. In this case, Marius Stafford has...
Well, let's cut to the chase on that. In terms of notice, what we have is, it seems to me, is a couple of points. One is a public record that on its face indicates he had notice. Let's start with that. Why is that insufficient to show notice?
Judge, are you referring to the notice,
the notation of the DMV transcript or record?
Okay, it's not clear that he had that at the time that he was...
No, the point is...
That was brought up at the trial, but not at the time he was driving. He never saw that.
Well, I know he said that, but my point is simply there's evidence in the record that there's a exhibit, which is a public record, that says notice of suspension / revocation received. Given the presumption of regularity that we accord public officials and their official duties, why isn't that evidence of notice?
Because I think you can attribute that to more than just the habitual offender. It does say notice of suspension or revocation received, but if you look back on his record, it says that he was suspended for failing to pay costs in 2011. He was suspended again later in 2011 for failing to pay costs, none of which have an order delivery date. But the point is, he was still suspended for other reasons other than the fact he was an habitual offender.
Well, if we accept that, then what about the point that the Commonwealth raises, which is this is not his first offense of being charged with driving after being declared a habitual offender, and he would certainly have been on notice of his status from his previous offense of that nature.
If you're referring to the previous one as being the one that he was charged with on October 14, 2013, he wasn't tried on that case until December 23rd after he was charged with this offense.
No, but he was charged with it prior to it.
He was charged with it, but there was never any testimony, unlike the cases that were cited by the Commonwealth, in which they had the testimony of the person, the officer who cited him in the earlier case, had come in to testify, and he testified that he had given him notice and he had given him a transcript. And I believe that was the Pittsburgh case, if I may have it wrong. But, it was the Hammer versus Commonwealth case that was cited in their brief. In that case, the defendant admitted he was a habitual offender, and the deputy testified about the earlier habitual offender misdemeanor. We didn't have that testimony. We didn't have the officer from the 2013 case, the October 14, 2013 case, testify in this case that either A, the defendant admitted that he was a habitual offender, or B, that he gave him a transcript or any of those things. So where this case differs from Hammer...
But there's no dispute he gave him a summons, right?
He gave him a summons, but summons is merely, as you know, the charge. It doesn't say anything about whether he's precluded or prevented from driving, and there's no testimony to that. So therefore, even if he gets charged with the offense, where does it say that he got the notice that he's no longer allowed to drive? He just simply gets a charge that says you're an habitual offender. And for most people who don't even know what that is, they just take it and they receive it and they sign it and they go to court to fight it. Until they get a lawyer, they don't really...
Pretty Byzantine statute.
Well,
I think we can all agree on that.
But I think the biggest problem with this case is that there was actually no notice. And when you look at the order of revocation in the case, which is in the appendix on page 42, I believe, there's an order of revocation in there. There's no evidence, even in the transcript, which is also in the appendix, that he ever got that order of revocation. So when you look at the delivery date on there, there is no delivery date. So we can assume, we can presume, we can do a lot of things, but there's no evidence that he ever received that order of revocation. And Judge, you spoke about the regularity, the presumption of regularity. I would just say the presumption of regularity says that it's presumed that a public official will do things correctly. I'd like to note that, first of all, when you look at the order of revocation, it was supposedly sent to his last known address. But if you look at all of the record, not just what's in the appendix, but the complete record, you'll see that his address was 1046 Hugo Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23513. What they sent him in the order of revocation was 1046 Hugo Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23518.
Was that raised below?
I'm sorry?
Did you raise that below at the trial court?
I didn't do the trial. That was not raised below.
Did counsel raise that? Okay.
He made a general objection to the concerning notice. But I don't think he raised that. But I'm just simply saying that with respect to the Commonwealth's argument that the presumption of regularity applies, it's presuming you do things correctly. Well, how can you presume it's done correctly when you can look at this document and see that it was not done correctly on its face? So therefore, I think it says presumption applies unless other evidence shows it wasn't done. I'm just pointing out the evidence that it wasn't done correctly. As far as the notice again, he was never convicted of the first habitual offender until well after he received the charge for the.
But why does that matter?
Second one, because it doesn't matter as far as being able to use it. You can use it. I don't think there's a ex post facto application there that applies. I'll concede that point. But I think it goes back to the notice. Again, we're talking about two different things, looking at the Hammer case, looking at the other cases that were cited. There is no, in fact, even the Pittsburgh case, in that case, unlike this case, we have no evidence that he ever received anything.
Let's assume he never actually received the letter from DMV. For the purpose of my question, let's assume that to be a fact. He's then given a summons for driving after being declared a habitual offender. Now he and that was prior to his arrest for this offense. Now he wasn't convicted of it until later, but he received a summons that would suggest, I would think, to any reasonable person that if you don't think you're a habitual offender, you need to look into it. In other words, if you don't know what it means, or you've just been issued a summons which commands you to appear in court on a certain day and defend yourself if you have a defense. It seems to me when someone is in effect charged with a criminal act like that, if they don't understand it, they're going to consult a lawyer, or they're going to call DMV, or they're going to call the officer, or they're going to do something to get to the bottom of it. So I'm still struggling with this idea that the summons would not be sufficient to put your client on notice of his status.
I'm sorry, Judge. I didn't mean to cut you off. Judge, I think you got to look at a couple of things. First, you're talking about somebody who's a non-lawyer who gets cited with a summons for a habitual offender. We don't know that he consulted a lawyer between October 14th and December 8th when he was charged with the second one.
I guess it just doesn't. I'm suggesting it just doesn't matter if you get a summons. You get a document that says you're a habitual offender. Whether that's true or not, he's got a piece of paper issued by a police officer that alleges that he's a habitual offender. Why isn't that notice of his status?
I'm sorry, because it doesn't. It does. I think there has to be another. There has to be actual notice, which you could argue that's. Again, we don't know what the testimony is. We don't know whether he was told what that really means, number one. But also, he has to be ordered not to drive. Now, we don't know, because there was no testimony in the case, whether he was ordered not to drive. We certainly know from the order of revocation that there's nothing in there that says he was ordered not to drive. And I would go one step further. In the Clements case, which the Commonwealth cites, they presented a notice of delivery.
Well, we know he was ordered not to drive. I think maybe you're drawing a distinction that I'm not catching, but we know he was ordered not to drive because DMV revoked his privilege to drive.
Well, we know that we know DMV revoked his privilege, but we don't know that he received it, so therefore, if he's ordered not to drive, but it never gets to him, is he really ordered not to drive? I guess that's the question. I'm arguing that he didn't. He wasn't ordered not to drive because it's great to keep something, if they kept it in their head, or they delivered to the wrong address, or they didn't deliver at all. They may have thought they ordered him to drive, but he wasn't ordered not to drive until he received actual notice. And even if you look at the one that he was charged with on October 14th, again, where's the testimony that was brought into this trial, the one we're dealing with now, that says that he was ordered not to drive, much like the case that I've just cited, in which was the Hammer case. And if you go to Clements, again, the case that they've cited, in that case, they not only submitted an order of revocation, they submitted a notice of delivery of the revocation. So we knew from that case, or from that case, that the person actually received it notice of delivery. In this case, there's no notice of delivery, and if you look at the transcript, there's nothing that says the order, any of these orders were ever received. And it makes sense that they weren't received if they didn't even go to the correct address. So I think the biggest problem is the when you look at the case that we're dealing with now over the case and your question to get to your question directly without sounding too redundant, is the big distinction is that in the Hammer case, the defendant admitted he was an habitual offender. In this case, the defendant did not. In Hammer case, the deputy testified about the earlier HO misdemeanor in the then present trial. In this case, they did not have that testimony. And he was told by the magistrate in Hammer. The magistrate said you're an habitual offender.
So if I understand your argument, being adjudicated a habitual offender, as was the case previously, as was the case in Hammer, is sufficient notice, but simply being charged with it is not.
I think there has to be some acknowledgement that he, at least that he received it, that he took it in. Being charged with an habitual offender offense and not being told, A, what it means, and B, that you're ordered not to drive.
What's your authority for the proposition that you have to have the law explained to you before it's effective?
The only authority I can cite is on the cases that are cited by the Commonwealth itself. When you look at all the cases in which they've upheld this, the notice requirement, they said that notice was at least, actual notice, it was at least good enough, were cases that involved either where he's been told directly that he was a habitual offender and ordered not to drive. And in this case, that didn't happen. So I don't have any. The only authority is the authority that's cited in the brief, but they're all distinguished from our case.
So the bottom line is just saying, hey, you've been adjudicated an habitual offender is not good enough. You need either the officer or the judge, or verbally or in some written form, to say you cannot drive.
Well, that's what the case law suggests. I mean, it's not.
No, I'm just trying to distill the bottom line where we are.
Yes. Mr. Wayman, you're into your rebuttal time. You keep on going if you
want. Oh, no, I'll thank you.
I didn't even see a clock.
What's up here?
Oh, we're all getting used to the new.
Yeah, this is new digs for us here.
Thank you.
Ms. Martin, how are you today?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Kathleen Martin for the Commonwealth. And I apologize for my voice. I will do the best I can.
I was there last week.
Ms. Martin, if you want to bring water up with you, you're welcome to do that. We all have been suffering from similar situations. And I really sound a lot better than I did yesterday. So we've got several aspects of notice in this case. First of all, as has been pointed out, that the DMV transcript does say notice of suspension revocation received. And that's on page 37. And on page...
Well, let me stop you right there, Ms. Martin, because your opponent suggests that that's not sufficient because the face of the transcript doesn't necessarily relate it back to the revocation for being a habitual offender. How does the Commonwealth respond to that allegation?
Well, I think under the presumption that officials do what they're supposed to do, if this is what it says, notice of suspension revocation received, the presumption is that it was sent and it was received. And the fact that...
I think your opponent's argument is that line taken in isolation doesn't necessarily indicate that the revocation was because of his status as a habitual offender. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I suppose you can say that, but I mean, I think that you have to look here that, you know, we do have the order, the letter in the back that said, you know, you've been determined to be an habitual offender, your privilege to drive has been revoked, and that there's nothing then where on page 40 where the revocation is, you know, there's nothing that says there's an order delivery date and so forth, and there's nothing there. There is no date there, but there's nothing there to say that this letter came back, that it wasn't received. And I believe it was the Bibb case, which is a case...
Well, I think the transcript indicates a letter was received that revoked his driving privileges.
Right.
And I guess, I gather from your argument is that when you look at the transcript as a whole, it's a reasonable conclusion that the revocation relates to the status of the habitual offender because of their proximity and
because if you look at the whole thing as a whole, that's the reasonable presumption from this. There's in the Bibb case that I was going to talk about, that there was something in the DMV transcript that, or there was other evidence that said whatever they sent out to him came back. I mean, that was noted in the transcript, but we don't have any of that here. And so certainly, if you look just at the transcript and that document, it does seem that he did have notice that he was an habitual offender and that he was not allowed to drive. But even if we put that aside and say that in October of 2013, he was stopped, he was charged with driving as an habitual offender. So at that point, even though he hadn't been convicted yet, at that point he did have notice that he was not to drive, that he had been declared an habitual offender. And at the trial in this particular case, then, they did admit the copy of the conviction order from December when he was convicted of that offense. Now, for some reason, on page 23 of the appendix, they talk about how that order is part of this exhibit that was supposed to come in with the DMV transcript. But the order itself does not appear anywhere in the record that came to the Court of Appeals. At least I was not able to find it. And so I don't know what happened to it as to why it didn't get sent or, you know, where it is.
Seek cert from the circuit court to see if it's...
Well, I will tell the court that I contacted the Commonwealth Attorney's Office to see if they could determine if, in fact, it was there somewhere, and then I would have done that. And I never got any kind of response as to where it was. So I don't know whether it was there or not.
Ordinarily, if there's something that's critical to the disposition of the case that may be in the clerk's office, we either the court sua sponte or one of the lawyers can file a petition for a certiorari and try to bring that.
Well, do we need that? I mean, as I understand it, you're referring to the court order of the conviction
right.
that occurred after.
Yes, and it occurred after, and it's not crucial, really. I mean, it's just, you know, that's sort of an observation, but it's not crucial. But we do have that order, and it was not objected to, and when it came into evidence in this case, and so that's kind of, you know, further proof that the defendant was really not contesting that he was an habitual offender.
Now, he certainly couldn't contest that he was a habitual offender after his conviction for that.
Right.
I think your opponent suggests that it's not enough just to be. It's not enough for notice purposes to simply be charged with driving on a habitual offender previously. So how does the Commonwealth respond
to
that?
Well, the Commonwealth's response is that yes, that would be actual notice. If you get a summons for something, you know, that shows you that you have.
Well, it's at least it's an allegation that you have this particular status and you ought not be driving a car.
Right, but in the Pritchard case, after the deputy sheriff, whoever it was, you know, said to Pritchard, well, you know, you can't drive, you're an habitual offender, and Pritchard said something like, well, I've got a good defense, I'm going to keep on driving. And there's some language in that opinion that his subjective belief really didn't matter. You know, that he doesn't have to intend to be an habitual offender or not be a habitual offender. That really has nothing to do with the offense. You know, you either are or you aren't. And so, you know, whatever Mr. Stafford thought about what he was told in October, whether he agreed with it or not, that's still notice for him that he was an habitual offender, that he'd been charged with driving and that he should not be driving. But yet he continued to drive. And 2 months later, an accident.
If the notice is simply that he's an habitual offender, but it doesn't then take the next step and say, and you can't drive, then he's on a duty of inquiry at that point, right? To
right,
figure
think,
out what this habitual offender terminology...
Right, but I mean, I think because the summons is you are charged with driving as an habitual offender, that, you know, it wasn't just, we're telling you you're a habitual offender, go figure out what that means. I mean, it's you know, there was a specific charge here.
Right,
there was
you're not
a
supposed
violation.
To be on the wheel.
Right, that you are not supposed to drive. And so certainly at that point, as in Pitchford and in Hammer, which is an unpublished case, the court found that the defendant had actual notice by virtue of the fact that he had been charged previously, and so certainly he had reason to know what his status was and that he should not be driving. And, you know, that's basically what this case is all about. I mean, if the DMV transcript is sufficient, he's got notice. If the fact that he had this earlier charge, and that gave him notice. He's got notice, and so
what's our standard of review for this assignment of error? It's not a sufficiency, at least it's not couched as a sufficiency issue. It's couched as a, I'm not sure what it is, really. The court erred in not dismissing the charge because the Commonwealth failed to prove the defendant received actual notice of his status as a habitual offender. So I'm not sure if it's abuse of discretion for the admission of the exhibit, or whether the standard of review is whether there was a preponderance of evidence of notice. In other words, what is our standard of review on this notice issue?
Well, I took the view that because really he was challenging the sufficiency of his conviction, and notice would be an element of that, that it's a sufficiency of the evidence case. And so it would be that kind of standard of review.
So your position is that it is a sufficiency argument.
Right. It is, because notice is something that you've got to prove. And so he's saying that the Commonwealth didn't prove that the trial court was wrong in finding that the Commonwealth did prove that. And so from that standpoint, it is a sufficiency case. It's a sufficiency standard of review.
Anything else, Ms.
I don't have anything else to say unless you have further questions.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. Mr. Wegman?
Your Honor, I'd like to point out a couple things.
Counsel, before you begin, can you tell us what you believe the standard of review is? Do you agree with the Commonwealth?
You wrote the assignment of error, yeah. So I hope you know what the standard of review is.
Well, I tend to think it has to be a sufficiency examination because of the fact that the judge allowed the document in.
Well, that would be an abuse of discretion. If there's if the objection is to the admission of the document, that's an evidentiary objection, which would bring up an abuse of discretion standard, that's why I asked the question. I'm not sure, and apparently you aren't either.
Well, I'll concede I'm not entirely. Maybe I should know, but I think that. To me, it goes to the essential elements of the offense. The elements weren't met, that's sufficiency or not.
Well, it seems to me that, and tell me if you disagree with this, the document on its face suggests that he received actual notice. I understand your argument to be that suggestion is erroneous because it's not that clear, and therefore it doesn't establish that he actually did receive notice. If that's your argument, then you're not really questioning the admissibility of the document. You're questioning the weight that it should have been given, I guess, as opposed to it shouldn't have been admitted in the first place, and then if it shouldn't have been admitted in the first place, there's no evidence of notice of his status.
Well, if by document you're referring to the DMV transfer,
right.
I believe there was an objection, if I recall, to that document coming in, but I could be wrong on that.
Well, that isn't my question. The question is, what's the assignment of error on appeal? Where do you think the trial court erred? Was it in admitting the document, or was it in concluding that the evidence was sufficient to show he had actual notice?
I think it's, if I could say both, I think it's both, because I don't think the document should have come in, because it doesn't say anything. At least it doesn't say what I think it should say, number one, and I think there was an objection to it. So I think that's been preserved. And I also think that even though he admitted it, you can still look and see whether it was sufficient. So I think you've got a little combination of things here. But, if I could, and I don't know how much time I have, but one thing I would like to clarify is that in the Pittsburgh case, the Commonwealth has cited to, in Pittsburgh, there was a driving suspended license case. It wasn't a habitual offender case. Now, some of the same things apply. You have to have actual notice. But in Pittsburgh, as you recall, from my recitation of it, that he was told by the deputy that he couldn't drive. He said, "Well, I think I've got a pretty good defense." Drove. If I could just wrap up my last sentence.
Wrap it up.
In that case, he was given notice because he was given notice pursuant to the statute, which was both actual notice because it was posted, which was allowed. And also, it was mailed to him 3 or 4 times. And they said in that case that the notice was sufficient because it was posted notice, which was permissible under the statute.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Wegman. We're going to come down as our custom and greet counsel and then take up that thing so annoying. And then take up the next case, which is Martin against the Commonwealth.
All rise.